extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer. Yes, all of you, thank you for listening. We love you, Extra Time faithful. But today is a big-time backheel day. Ben Wright is going to join me, as well as Joe Lowry. Of course, every single Monday I'm reading Ben on the Eastern Conference games and Joe on the West. And today we will do it in person. We'll chat about them. Wednesday night was, in a word, crazy. The third most goals, I believe, all time in a single day in MLS history. And I'm tired, folks. We'll see if I can get a little bit of energy to make this show what you expect and love. I'm looking forward to a wrap on a Thursday night. But I'm thinking back to last night, 2:30 a.m., heading down the East River in an Uber on the way to the George Washington Bridge. And what comes on but Don't Stop Believing, Journey. And in my mind, I thought, Don't Stop Believing. That's sort of a little bit of a parable for the current point of the MLS season. We're about halfway through, and for some teams, they're chasing the supporters' shield. For other teams, they're chasing the playoffs, and others are just chasing straight-up respectability. So whether you're elite, whether you're mid, whether you're trash, this is the time of the year where the fuse starts running out. Be who you want to be. And who were you on Wednesday night? Well, let's find out. Starting the Eastern Conference with Ben Wright. All right, let's dig in and bring some special guests on to do so. Ben Wright gets us started on the Eastern Conference for Match Day 21. You can read him, of course, at Broadway Sports and at Backheel. That's what I do every single Monday. It is a Ben Joe Lowry back-to-back for me. Some confirmation bias, perhaps, on my part, looking for some new ideas, but I really appreciate all the work and time you guys put in. Ben, welcome back to Extra Time, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, let's dig in. Best thing we saw, we're going to double up. We're going to do Eastern Conference with you, Western Conference with Joe, just the way I like it, lists. What's the best thing you saw in the East on Wednesday night?
It has to be Ian Freeman. Coming back from three ACL tears, first game back, takes him 10 minutes to score. I remember when he got injured, just kind of the outpouring of support from Miami players, which I thought was pretty cool to see, especially from a lot of the big names who had just got there. It seemed like they pretty quickly took him under their wings. And then just the team celebration after he scored, you could tell it meant more than just a goal. I mean, obviously for him, but for the entire team who supported him. I just checked on his Instagram, and man, I'm just going to read it. The caption that he put out was pretty spectacular. Here he goes. He says, "Wow, what a feeling. It's hard to put this into words, but this is for anyone going through a rough time with injuries or whatever the case may be. Everyone goes through different things in life, and sometimes you think that life is unfair or why me? And it's normal to think that way. But what really shapes who you are as a person is how you respond when it feels like everything is going against you. Always keep a smile on your face and stay focused on your main goal, and everything will work out. Thank you to everyone that supported me on this journey. I am back." I mean, man, how can you not love them? That was awesome. It was fun to see. And not that Miami need more good storylines, but man, it's hard to not just tune into Miami every week, because every week it's going to be something else.
I am back. I love those three words from Ian Frey. And the crazy thing is, it's those three words, but it's three straight seasons, as you referenced. How much can one person undertake? How much weight can be on one kid's shoulder? Because yeah, he's 21 years old. So, you know, is he by societal definitions a man? Sure. Was I a man at 21? Heck no. Certainly not a maturity level, not going through the same level of adversity that he's gone through. And just like you, I remember the moment. I remember the jersey, the team holding it up, and just the thought of like, man, not again. Not again for this guy who's just trying to get his professional career started. So yeah, look, could the marking from Columbus have been better? Sure, of course. Wilfred Nancy's going to look at that set piece and say, oh, we need to do a little bit better here. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to remember that in the end. All Ian Frey is going to remember is that he got to the near post, flicked it to the back post, probably blacked out for a little while, and in his first game back, like, there wasn't a run out before this. They had issues because of red card suspension, because of injuries, because of international absences. They needed to rely on the whole squad. Last game, it's two super draft picks, Ben. This game, it's Ian Frey coming back from his third ACL. It's like you can't kill Miami. No matter what you do, they just grow another appendage and just keep punching you in the face. It's absolutely incredible. Speaking of youngsters, and Julian Hall is a little bit younger than our boy Ian Frey here. 16 years, 87 days, the second youngest player to score in Major League Soccer. Julian Hall gets it done. And I vividly remember earlier this year going out to Montclair to watch a Red Bulls 2 game with my boys, watching Julian Hall play, texting BWP and being like, this kid's really interesting. Like, he's a little bit, he's not the finished product here. And there's some moments where he could be better, but he is really interesting. And Brad said, yeah, watch out. He's going to impact the first team sooner than you think. Bang. Here it is. The Red Bulls down, need a game tying goal. Who else but the 16-year-old to kind of have just good instincts, BWP-like instincts in the box, that little step toward the near post, but then recognizing, hey, where the ball's going, but more importantly, where it's heading is this way. When we get in position, just a deft little header to nod it in, and he gets a goal that, you know, it changes his life.
And he was pretty fearless too, because, I mean, that's, he kind of just threw himself at that ball in a crowded box with, I mean, grown men defending him. Maybe I'm not even going to say that it's just kind of like youthful naivety or whatever. I think he just has instincts, and he saw the ball, he saw the goal, and he wanted it more than anybody else on the field. And you love to see that from a 16-year-old kid.
Great signs for the Red Bulls, another academy product. Moving on through, I just want to shout out also from Montreal on that 2-2 draw. One, our boys Kalen Carr and Cal Williams, always love listening to them. But two, Mahalo, Opoku is back. Kwadwo is back, baby. He got a goal in this one, a nice a finish from him. Matias Kokoro is back as well. So Montreal have been sort of fighting with two arms tied behind their back in terms of injuries and absences. This is big for Laurent Courtois to get those guys back. All right, let's dig into the biggest matches in the East. And we have to start with sort of a familial battle. Cincinnati, Philadelphia, so many connections between these two teams. They played some great games over the years, and they've been battling for the past few years for, really sort of that top spot in the Eastern Conference in large part. Cincinnati have maintained, Philly haven't, and Cincinnati got the magic in the end from their man Lucho, a 4-3 win, but it's all about the number 10, Ben. Anytime you think it's over, anytime you think Cincinnati are out, anytime you think Lucho is just having an average to below average game, as he did, by the way, against San Jose, there's like this flip inside of him where he's like, oh, hell no, not this time. Not us. We're not dropping points. I'm not going to have a game that's forgettable. I'm going to find a way to get my moment. And the moment came with sort of a vintage moment at the top of the box in zone 14. When you find him in space with room to move, and he doesn't need much, one touch, two touch, three touch, two defenders just sort of unable to even throw in a challenge. And then just the calmest, most composed, called game finish into the bottom corner. Cincinnati roll out and Lucho rolls to the corner flag. And I don't know what he was saying. Maybe my Spanish lip reading is not up to snuff. I was imagining SOS Mi Casa, this is my house. I am that guy. I don't know what it was, but the demonstrative nature of Lucho at the end of the game just saying, I own this. This is my team. And when I say we're going to win, we're going to go do it.
I mean, after the game, he literally compared himself to fine wine and said, I get better with age. So I don't think he's shying away from anything. The crazy thing, too, is, I mean, he had a goal and an assist before stoppage time, which, I mean, great performance anyway. It kind of felt just like another day at the office for him. Like, oh, yeah, it's just Lucho doing his thing. Nothing too spectacular. And then he pulls out that stoppage time winner. And they're like, oh, OK, there's the moment that we needed from Lucho. I mean, he just keeps pulling out those moments. And I feel like, obviously, he talked about before the season about wanting to repeat the MVP award. I think he has a ton of competition this year. Obviously, Messi, Chicho Arango, Denny Bawanga, even Cucho. I mean, there are a ton of other names who have cases, and I think are going to keep building cases. But as much as anything, I feel like it's a narrative award, and you need to have like kind of landmark moments to point at. And he just keeps racking those up more than I think maybe anybody in the league except for Messi. He has those big moments where he just stands head and shoulders above anybody else. I thought that was spectacular. Just the way he picked up the ball, you knew exactly what he was going to do. I think the defenders knew what he was trying to do, but he was a step ahead of them every time. He put them off balance. He's quicker to the ball than anybody else. But then when he gets on the ball, he has it's Messi-esque, just kind of his low center of gravity and his ability to just beat you at full speed while maintaining complete control. It was just spectacular. And I mean, the crazy thing is we're not even talking about Luka Rajano's goal, which is one of the best goals of the season, just because of how much Lucho stood out. And he's special, man. He's halfway into the season and he's already tied his assist total from last year when he won MVP. I mean, he's getting better. It's crazy.
We'll get to Orellano in a second. We have to wax poetic on Lucho. I think you're spot on in the sense of, one, MVP being a narrative award. Two, Lucho just accumulating moments. And I'm calling it Lucho time. Like, I'm just going to start calling it that. I remember, like, last year against Vancouver. Remember, they went cross-country, and he came off the bench and was like, well, gosh, they need this moment to keep their run going. Can they win the Shield? And he's like, I got that moment. Yeah, it's in the bag. 6-game winning goals so far this year for Lucho. Leads Major League Soccer. You said it, 14 assists. That's number one in MLS. 66 key passes. That's number one in MLS. And I just want to compare this year to last year. Right now, halfway through the season for FC Cincinnati, 9 goals, 14 assists. All of 2023, 17 goals, 14 assists. Let's just go back to key passes. And if you don't know what those are, it's just a pass directly leading to a shot. It's like a pretty straightforward measure of creativity and essentially shot creation, which is everything. 66 this year in half a season, 87 last year. Think about that. Think about the level he was at in 2023, the way he brute forced in large part Cincinnati and their attack to a supporter shield. Now he's doing it again at a better level. And by the way, only 3 players ever in MLS have hit 20 assists. Like, mark it down right now. I put it, chisel it in stone. This man is hitting 20. He is making it 4. Pipe Valbuena is the number one at 26. That came in a different era when assists were counted in a different way. Basically, second assists were any pass to a pass that leads to a goal was an assist. So it's not even the same sort of metric. The other two on 20, Maxi Morales and Sasha Kljestan. He is getting there. He's going to pass Sasha Ben this year for number 8 on the all-time assist list. He's 7 back. He's got 92.
He might hit 20 before League's Cup.
For sure.
Yeah, why stop at 20? I mean, I think he could get close to 30.
He's on pace for 26.4. And I know you can't have 0.4 of an assist, but just, I mean, try to wrap your mind around that. 26 assists in a season on a different sort of scale of measurement than the current record holder. I just struggle to put it really in perspective. And I start thinking long-term. I start thinking about Landon Donovan on 136 for his career. Lucho is 30. You said it. If he's like fine wine, this is only going one direction. He is only getting better. He is maturing in front of our eyes. Every single season in Cincinnati, we've seen leaps. Don't forget, he was on a spoon team. The old Lucho, the DC Lucho, the one that was immensely talented, but sometimes inconsistent, sometimes not completely checked in, sometimes a little bit immature. Yeah, that guy's long gone. This is a determined, elite winner who is dragging his team behind him. And don't forget, half this team is new.
It's crazy. And I mean, you just mentioned half the team is new. I mean, he's the piece that's holding it all together. But I think he's making the team better. I mean, they're leading the supporter shield race in points per game. But I think, too, you've got to look at a guy like Kevin Kelsey who comes in. And I think he's just immediately hit the ground running. I think he's a really good player, to be fair. I think that's part of it. They got the signing right. But also, like, how can you not be a great player when you have a guy like Lucho Acosta behind you taking all the pressure off of you? And I mean, yeah, I'm kind of running out of words to describe Lucho, because it feels like if his teammates aren't going to do it, he can just do it himself, but he can also set them up. He's just doing everything. It's hard not to look at him and think he's a top 2 player in MLS right now.
I'm looking at the numbers at his career and what he could accomplish. Like, let's say he gets an MLS Cup. When you're talking about number 10s at the end for Lucho, you're talking about, you know, top 5. Top 3. Like, he has the ability to get into those spaces. And to go to your point about Kelsey, like, you could also bring Orellano into this. I mean, imagine you are Luke Orellano and you're in Brazil and you're trying to find a new destination, a new place to thrive, a place to really sort of, you know, get to your potential. And your boy from Vélez, Álvaro Barrial, and they have to have talked to each other extensively about these moves, hits you up and says, hey, I'm leaving. I've played left wing back for the last couple of years. I know you play right wing. That's where you prefer. But if you can get to Cincinnati and you can get in the same space as Lucho on a game-to-game basis, one, it's going to be incredible for you. And two, it's just going to make things easier. You're going to play with a guy who essentially has the ball on a string. Like, when I watch Lucho, I think of those training aids where you have the Velcro strap that goes around your ankle, and it's on like the bungee cord string and a net. Did you ever have one of these growing up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's I don't know. You can kick it and it comes right back at you. So you're training touch and you're training, obviously, your strike. But like for Lucho, that cord is 6 inches long. Like it's just on his foot at all times. And the gravity around him gives all the space in the world for Orochano. And to be fair, I don't think that Philadelphia thought giving Orochano the space that they did at freaking midfield was going to result in a pinged golazo into the top of the back of the net. But here we are in this day and age, Ben. It just feels like it feels contagious. It feels like everybody's watching the highlights around the league and they're like, yeah, no, I could do that too. You know, if all these other guys can do it, why I'm going to try it. Why not?
I mean, that's confidence, right? Like if your team is playing well, you feel confident to try stuff like that. I mean, Pat Noonan said that after the game, that's a play that a confident player makes. And I feel like it's, like you said, it's infectious. It starts with Lucho and it's going through everybody there. I think there's the Supporter Shield favorites again. I think you could even make an argument that we all talked about how huge it would be for them losing Brendan Vasquez and Alvaro Barrial in the winter. And I think you can make an argument that they've upgraded on them, which is just absolutely insane to say. That's crazy. I mean, if you look at the, like, just break down the numbers, Kevin Kelsey's goals per 90 is significantly better than Brendan Vasquez. He's at 0.71 goals per 90. Brendan Vasquez at 2022, his best year in Cincinnati, he was at 0.58. So, I mean, he's come in and significantly outperformed that. I don't think there's been a drop-off at all with Orochano, and I think you're seeing him kind of build that same connection in the final third that we saw last year. It was almost telepathic between Barrial and Acosta, and I think you're seeing the same type of thing now with him and Lucho. It's crazy. And yeah, this was a Supporter Shield contender just like 2 or 3 years ago, which is, they're the best team in MLS now. It's just wild how not only did they just flip the switch 1 year, but they keep one-upping themselves and keep getting better. And yeah, it's just a ridiculous story. And I think one that we're in the moment, it's insane to talk about, but I think we're going to look back on this for a long time as just one of the biggest transitions in the history of MLS. And I think the starting point for what should be long-term, one of the most successful and kind of solid teams in the league. I think they've already laid the foundations and it looks like this is pretty sustainable for a long time.
I completely agree with you. I mean, the ambition, the decision makers that are involved, the investment that ownership is putting in, the fact that it just doesn't seem like they want to rest on their laurels in any way. You know, even with Bupenza, you know, big signing, big money, big expectations, hasn't met those expectations just yet. He just got cleared for contact, which is why he was on, I believe, the bench in this game, but we haven't seen him back yet. But it seems like the writing on the wall is that they might move on from him this summer and go invest at an equal or even greater level to keep this project going. I give so much credit to the club, to the staff, and I got to say to the fans as well. I mean, this is like the just reward, the just desserts of living through those 3 years of misery at the bottom of the standings. And we'll talk about the juxtaposition here in terms of the transfer dealings and the style of play between Cincinnati and Philadelphia, because there's something there. But, you know, we're waxing poetic, but I just want to point out after this game, Pat Noonan was pretty frustrated. He was just like, yo, this was not a good performance and this is not acceptable from us to give up 3 goals in this manner. And a lot of it comes down to personnel. You know, they are trying to field the back line, and that 3-5-2 is really settled systematically for Cincinnati. That's the way they want to play. It's what gets the best out of the attacking personnel and the midfield, and it's probably what gets the best out of the back line in this configuration without Miles Robinson and Matt Miazga, because you don't have Miles Robinson and Matt Miazga. Like, if you had one of those guys, maybe you could go to a back four, but as it stands, you need the numbers back there to defend. So to start this game, it was Kip Keller in the central position at center back, Ian Murphy on the left side, and Nick Hagelin on the right. And Keller got cramps like 60 minutes in and had to come out. So Alvis Powell comes in, which we saw last year in the playoffs when Miazga was suspended, into that back three. But there's an issue here, Ben, because, you know, talking to the people in Cincinnati, and they've done the press conferences as well, we still don't know the diagnosis for Matt Miazga. This could be long-term. Like, initially it was a laceration, and that was the concern. Now it's the knee, and he had an MRI, and we're waiting to see what that means. But I can tell you right now, Cincinnati are preparing to potentially change their summer transfer plans, because if Matt Miazga is out on the longer term end, which seems like a very real possibility, Cincinnati are going to have to make a change and make an addition on that back line. how much would this concern you in the sense of Shield pace? Because I think, hey, good team, going to be a home team in the playoffs, top four, probably top two or three seed realistically. I think you can lock that down. But the Shield is what I'm thinking about with this team. And all of a sudden, that's a little bit of a shaky point.
I think they can make it work with Miles Robinson back for the rest of the year. I mean, they did it last year with just Matt Miazga. And so I think you can almost run the same thing back. You don't get the upgrade that you thought you had in the offseason with both of them, but I think just Robinson back fixes a lot of that. I think this probably means, I would be really surprised if Olympics happens for Robinson at this point. I know he was kind of, there was some chatter about him being one of the overage players. I just don't see how Cincinnati let him go with Miazga gone for a year. I'm still pretty confident in just Pat Noonan's structure overall. And I think Robinson is a good enough defender that he can kind of have that impact on the rest of the back line. I think he's one of those guys. He's an elite defender on his own, but I think he kind of raises the level of everyone around him. So I'm not super worried about their defense if he's there, but they're going to have to navigate the next couple weeks regardless. He's with the US at Copa America. They're going to have to figure that out. I think you have to at least be looking around the league at trade options, maybe not going out and spending big on an international signing in the summer. But I think you have to look and see if there's someone who can toss some game at and get a starting quality center back just to kind of hold things over until the end of the year. I don't know. Like, we've been waxing poetic about them and just the decision-making and the roster building, though. So I think if there's any team in the league who can handle this, I think it's Cincinnati and a very short list of other teams that can kind of navigate this type of thing.
The thing about Miazga, if he is indeed out, we don't know. We're still waiting for the diagnosis, so I don't want to go too far down that road other than the hypotheticals right now. We hope he's going to be okay. Is that everything that staff has said about him in particular in relation to the other guys, and this is a lot in the playoffs last year when he was working with, you know, Mascara and younger guys like Ian Murphy, is just as a communicator, as a leader, there's really nobody back there that can match his ability to be vocal and organize in any given moment. And Robinson has incredible physical gifts, and he's just got all these things 1v1 and on the ball that you love. I'm not sure he's the same in terms of that vocal leadership that Miazga is, but I agree with you. U.S. soccer, man, if Miazga's out long-term, you're already taking Robinson to Copa. You got to just read the room a little bit. Like, that is such a huge tax on a club to take a starting center back away for basically two full months. And look, if Robinson wants to go and U.S. soccer calls him for the Olympics, Cincinnati will let him go. Like, they're not going to stand in his way, but I would be surprised just knowing the context around this if that happened. We'll see. I've been surprised many times before. All right, let's go to Philadelphia. Before we go to the, oh boy, this again side, how about this? Tiberbo has been waiting. He's been waiting a year, Ben, for an opportunity. He had played 180 minutes in the league for Jim Curtin. He had two starts. Jim said he earned it in training. Obviously, Julian Carranza is not coming back. So, Barbo gets a start, and he scores two goals. Well done, man. Sitting around for a year, probably super frustrated, wondering what can you do to get on the field, and then you take a chance like that. That's good stuff. But on the flip side, yet again, it's four goals allowed. It's a gut punch loss. Is Jim Curtin, I mean, I've not wanted to say this because I thought it was more about personnel than it is about Jim. Is Jim Curtin under pressure?
I don't know. I don't think I'm ready to go there yet. I think he's just what he's done over the last 5 years. I think he's built up a lot of credit and a lot of goodwill. And I think structurally the team is still probably fine. I really think it's down to personnel. It feels a lot like Sporting Kansas City to me. You had a core that was pretty successful, overperforming in a lot of ways, given kind of the spend. I think they ran it back a year, maybe even 2 years too long. And I think it's coming back to bite them. I think they really needed to reload. I mean, last year probably, but definitely this winter. And I think they brought back some guys. Instead of spending, they brought back guys like Bedoya and Wagner. I think those moves are fine, but you got to do that in addition to new signings. And I think that was it for them. I mean, Julian Carranza's leaving. He's like a once in a lifetime deal. They didn't get him because they got him because Miami spent too much. And then they grabbed him for pennies on the dollar and got a like a best 11 caliber striker for I think 500k in GAM. Yep. That mm-hmm. doesn't happen. That's not like that's a
it's
core
not sustainable.
That's
it's
a core piece of their identity, and that move does not happen again. It's legitimately not gonna. They're not gonna make that deal again. They're gonna have to go out and spend $5-6 million on someone to replace him. I don't know if the ownership is willing to do that. I think I put most of this down to just lack of spending, and I think their kind of transfer approach. It was great when it worked. They were kind of like the plucky team who supplemented their team with youth academy products and somehow were able to find deals that no one else could find. And I think just the rest of the league is spending more. First of all, they're also getting smarter, so it's harder to stand out as kind of like the under the radar signing team when everybody else in the league is getting better at that. And so if you're not going to spend, it's just really hard to be competitive. I don't care how good you are as a coach, how good your structure is. I mean, I think Cincinnati have done a lot of the similar things on the field that we've seen Columbus do. They've supplemented it with spending and much better signings. And I think you're now seeing them able to take some steps forward tactically just because they have players who can implement it. And I think as much as it sounds weird to say, I think Philadelphia is maybe getting left behind a little bit.
I'm thinking about, we can even go player by player here. Or even the transfer window, you know, when Cincinnati had to refresh their entire squad, because when you have success, players get sold. And for Philly, it was the same. When you have success, players get sold. Most of their players being sold have been academy products until now, like the Mark McKenzie's of the world and, you know, Brendan Aronson's, and now Julian Carranza is the latest in that line. But, you know, it's Kelsey, it's Orshano, it's Boucha, it's Wobodo, you know, back when that one was signed. It's Matt Miazga on TAM. It's going and trading for Miles Robinson. You know, it's DeAndre Yedlin in the trade market. It's signing Aaron Bupenza. It is a laundry list of moves that are at a spending level and a profile level that the Philadelphia Union have not approached. And so I stick by what I said on the last show, which is that Union have all these attributes of a club that can be sustainably successful for a long time in terms of club culture, in terms of the way they bring academy talent through, their ability to find diamonds in the rough. That doesn't have to stop. It just needs to be supplemented if they want to have the same ambitions that they've had for the last 5 years and couldn't quite get to, which is win a championship. Now, in this game, Jim changed things up just a little bit, and they're having some issues because of international absences, but he went to the 3-5-2 against Cincy, and he knows Pat Noonan well, and he knows the system that Pat plays well, and the three is in the back is the combat, the two in the front for Cincinnati. But, like, they got in behind Harriel a couple times with Kelsey. There were these moments where it just didn't quite work. And ultimately what it comes down to for Philly, their biggest strength has become their biggest weakness. They used to be monsters in both 18s. Certainly, you know, in their ability to cause chaos in the attack and get numbers in the box and, you know, finish. But even more so, the foundation was Andre Blake. So you're not going to get any cheap, easy goals. The center backs and the defensive midfielder giving you no time, space, or ability to be efficient or to have clean looks in and around the 18. That's not happening. Like, it feels like everything, every opportunity, every break that can go against them, every half chance just hits the back of the net. And when that happens, well, Philadelphia lose games, they drop down the table, and they lost their first road game in Cincinnati. It was a classic. All right, let's keep moving. Miami-Columbus. Massive bounce week for Inter-Miami. 2-1 wins, won by, you know, super draft semi-miracle, it seemed like, against Philadelphia. And then this one with a couple early goals that they held on to against the Columbus Crew. What was your big takeaway, your overriding story from this game?
I mean, we talked all offseason about Miami's depth and just kind of the roster they were assembling. I don't think anybody thought their depth would come from guys like Ian Frey and Noah Allen playing kind of as a makeshift center back. Tata, by the way, said,
I think this guy is a center back. He looks small, but I think from his attributes, they like him at center back.
Totally. I mean, and he's been good there. It's just crazy to me that they're pulling out these kind of results with depth, but like the depth that none of us were really talking about. When we talked about depth, we were talking about like all the Matias Rojas type signings that they're making. And then he's getting production from super draft picks. I mean, it's just unbelievable how they managed to still get results. The past 2 weeks they've pulled out results, even though I think they were the worst team in both games. And I think that's really the sign of a good team, that you can win even when you're playing poorly. I think they did some things well. So it wasn't all poor for Miami last night. But I mean, Columbus kind of bombarded them for the last 70, 80 minutes of the game. And they hung on at home and got a point without like seven starters, or got 3 points without seven starters. So, I mean, yeah, I think I was concerned about the how they would handle the international break, losing Messi, Suarez, all these guys. And they're kind of flying through it. I think they're more than keeping their heads above water. And I think Messi's going to get back into this team. I mean, not just Messi, but, you know, it's Messi's team. He's going to come back. They're going to be in fine position. And I think I'm really expecting a pretty big second half bump from them down the stretch. And it's just kind of scary to think about a Miami team getting hot in the second half of the year towards playoffs. And I mean, we talked about Cincinnati. I think they're probably the favorite for Supporter Shield, but I don't think if you're looking towards playoffs, which I know it's a long way away, but I mean, if you're looking at playoffs, there is no one and no team in MLS that wants to face a hot Miami in a one-off game. And that's kind of scary.
Full strength crew.
Right.
It's a full strength crew against an absolutely ravaged Miami team. And look, games change, or goals change games. And for Miami, generally, it's been goals that they give up early and they flip the script in this one. And we talked about Ian Frey, he gets the set piece. And then the crew are just playing around in the back far too much. And Campana takes advantage. And now Columbus are down 2-0. And I think what Wilfred Nancy really wanted to do in this game was, you know, up the intensity level. And crew don't get enough credit for the way that they press, the way they turn teams over, and then the transition moments that come from those moments. And I think for Wilfred, and talking to him last week, it's just sort of like, okay, well, we were trying to balance things with CONCACAF, and we didn't really have the energy to go press and to go be as intense and have the running that I would like this team to have, because we just had to balance things. Physically, it wasn't really possible. They got a 13-day break. And I think, given Miami's weakness, which is giving up the ball in bad spaces and not being organized behind it, Wilfred figured, okay, if we can push them into possessing, which they say they still want to do, even without Messi and Suarez, we could just tear this team apart on the break. And that's why Matan and Rossi and Cucho up top are your starters. But when the game is 2-0 early on, thanks in large part to Miami shifting things and pressing pretty high, well, all of a sudden, the game state changes. All of a sudden, what you expect the opponent to do changes, and Miami has 33% possession at home, and they just say, okay, well, shoot from outside the box. We'll limit your very best chances. And still, the crew had enough to win, I thought. They just weren't efficient. And they'll walk out with a 2-1 win. I saw Tata and Wilfred talking at the end of the final whistle, and obviously we're not there. We don't know what they said. But it was one of those things when you're reading body language, shout out Bobby Warshaw, where Tata's smiling, kind of patting him on the side, and you can just imagine him saying, hey, you probably deserve more out of this game, but well done. Well done. Really respect your team.
Yeah, and as good as Columbus are with the ball, I still think they love transition more than anything. And even the moments that they play really well with the ball, it's when they're under pressure, kind of in their own defensive third, combining with the back line and midfield to kind of break out of that pressure quickly and then get the ball into open space. They're elite at that. They're not as elite at breaking down a packed defense, which is obviously, I mean, that's the hardest thing to do in soccer, is to break down a low block. And that's what Miami did once they went up two. So, I mean, I don't have any kind of long-term concerns about Columbus. I think they still, even against Miami's defense, I think they still probably create enough to at least get a point from this, potentially win it. They could have done a little bit better in the final third with some of the chances that they got. So I'm not super concerned about them. They've done really well on the road up until now. I mean, they've navigated their run to the CONCACAF Champions Cup. I mean, they're still in the Supporter Shield race. Every time we've seen a team make a deep run, their MLS performance has just kind of dropped off. I don't think we're seeing that from Columbus. I think they've handled things really, really well. So I'm not super worried about them. Definitely not from this performance. I think they'll kind of be fine long-term.
Yeah, I completely agree. I will say, you know, like, speaking of teams that dropped off, Seattle, Toronto come to mind. We're hanging with Robin Fraser yesterday in the studio, and he was just like, I don't know how they're doing this. Because when we lost the final emotionally, it took 3 or 4 months for guys to sort of get their minds wrapped back around, you know, shifting and refocusing and moving past that. And it seems like the crew have done that pretty darn quickly. Now, they got some issues in the summer. If Aiden Morris leaves, like, who's going to replace Morris? And there's not a like for like on the roster right now, in my opinion. So I know we saw AZ come in and Dylan Chambos, but they feel like more of the tens behind the forward. So you would expect the crew and Issa Tall to be pretty active in the transfer window. We'll see what that looks like. All right, one more game and we'll get you out of here, Ben. Toronto-Nashville. I didn't really get to watch enough. I just saw John Herdman furious after the match because Nashville got a couple let's say, cheap goals to win 2-1. What was the rundown for you?
I kind of expected more from Toronto, to be honest. Herdman was on fire after the Chicago game. I think he said it was the most disappointed he's been in his entire 30-year career, whether it was women's, youth, men's, international, at any level. He kind of didn't hold back. I thought it would be a much more of a bounce back game from Toronto. And I mean, they were really good in the first half. They got a penalty kick that Bernadeschi slipped and hit it over the bar. Then I think it was like 5 minutes later that they eventually went ahead, and they were really putting Nashville under a ton of pressure. I think they outshot them like 13-4 in the first half or something like that. It was pretty one-sided. I don't know what Rumba Munthali said at halftime, but it completely switched. And Nashville just came out the better team in the second half. The main thing for me is that Sam Surridge played the entire match in Toronto as a left winger. He played the last 30 minutes of their game against the Red Bulls as a left winger, and I think he was significantly better. I think he gets maybe typecast a little bit as a target forward just because he's English and 6'3" or whatever, but he's fine in the air. He's not elite in the air. Definitely not when you're just kind of lumping balls at him and hoping he can do something. But I would put him a top finisher in MLS with the ball at his feet. He kind of has that trademark finish where the ball comes across the box and he's in that left channel. He just opens up his hips and hits it far post first time. He does that really, really well. And he did that again for his first goal. So I think being able to get him kind of in that left half space consistently with a ball at his feet, that's where you're going to get the best out of him. And maybe playing him as kind of like a left start, making his starting points from the left wing, at least, kind of gets that from him. So it's an interesting shift. And then obviously he got the stoppage time winner off of a Tyler Boyd assist, who I think is going to be pretty important to Nashville if they can keep him healthy. They really haven't seen the best of their attack all healthy at once. So I think maybe getting those guys back at the same time will help. But yeah, I think it's been better under Munthali. Definitely better than I expected. He's done more than keep their heads above water. They're in playoff place now. So yeah, kudos to him. I think he's done a good job.
Love to see Hani in that sort of open space, throwing, you know, scissors and finding the big man on the left for that sweeping finish. So more of that from Hani Mukhtar. We know he can change a team, but haven't seen that level quite consistently enough for Nashville. Herdman was real frustrated. And it comes from, you know, the first goal coming off his team's own throw-in and the second goal being late, basically into stoppage time. And you let Tyler Boyd get turned and get down the inline to provide service to the near post. That is going to infuriate any coach. And the shine is officially off for Toronto FC. I think it's one win in their last 8 games. They're still in playoff position on 24 points and 7th. But the form is sort of evaporating right now. And by the way, I think you got to give PK duties away from Bernadeschi. Insigne was holding the ball to start and he gave it to Fede. And then Fede slipped and missed it. And I know it's not his fault, but he's now 0-3 on the year. Like, when you're 0-3, I know you were 6-6 coming in to the season, but when you're 0-3, probably somebody needs to get a different chance.
Even just for his sake, like take the mental load off of him.
You have Insigne. Come on, he could hit a penalty. Osorio could be an option when he comes back from Copa. Let's talk before I let you go here about BJ Callahan and the Nashville job. What are you hearing? What are you feeling about what might happen here with a decision as far as a new manager goes?
I mean, I'm defaulting to Tom Scoops on this, but I think he is the front runner from everything I've heard. And I mean, obviously everything Tom's reporting. Interested on timing, because obviously Copa America is happening right now. When they fired Gary Smith, Mike Jacobs talked a lot about just wanting to make the move now when there was still something to play for. And it's been a month since they fired him. So I kind of took that to mean that they were going to make a move quickly and really try to get things going. And it's already been a month. If it's Callahan, I don't expect it'll be for the next 3 or 4 weeks. So that's a little bit strange, but I think his profile makes a lot of sense. The two things Nashville really needed to improve at were playing with the ball and developing their own talent. I think Greg Berhalter's model should at least lend itself to playing with the ball more. And really, I don't think it's a high bar for getting better in possession. So I think he should be able to help in that regard. But then his background, obviously, with the Union, in the Union Academy, they needed someone who would be able to not just develop their own academy products, but the new signings that they're bringing in. They've wanted to get younger. They've wanted to be able to bring in more kind of unfinished products, develop them in Nashville for 2 or 3 years and then sell them on. So I think those are the two priorities, and just kind of from the outside, it looks like Callahan should check both of those boxes.
All right. For more coverage as that story keeps developing, you know where to go. Remind people, Ben, where can they find you?
Yeah. Check out BroadwaySportsMedia.com for everything Nashville, Backheel.com. Obviously I have the Eastern Conference recaps every week. Joe does the West. He's going to do a ton of Copa America stuff too. It's going to be awesome. So check that out. And then I'll put everything out on Twitter, at Ben Wright.
I am a happy subscriber to Backheel. I cannot recommend it enough. If you enjoy extra time just for the Monday recaps, it is well worth the very, very modest investment. And there's so much more on that side. I can't even get to all. Ben, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Thank you.
All right, let's keep the Backheeled party going. Joe Lowry joins the show now. Welcome to Extra Time, Joe. Always glad to have you. East, West, it's like my Monday recap is living in my ears. It's wonderful. It's strange. It's what I would love to have every Monday if Doyle wasn't around.
I love that for you, Weeby. Thanks for having me. It has been a blast doing the East, West rundown with Ben every Monday. It has kept us extremely busy, as I think you can imagine and relate to, but it's been so much fun. Ben kills it on the East. I try to keep up on the West. We have a good time.
Hey, look, there's nothing like following 29 teams in minutia every single week. It really keeps the mental fortitude, the mental capability, the mental sharpness either strong or completely dull and blunted. I'm not sure which it is.
It's just one extreme. I don't know which it is either, but it's definitely one of those two paths.
It depends on how much sleep I've gotten, and today I've gotten very little sleep. So let's keep it a little bit, let's keep it sharp but a little goofy, and let's start with the best thing we saw in the Western Conference. I'm not going to say you stole this from me, but I did write in the rundown, Logan Hot Dog Farrington passes out free glizzies.
That's I'm going to come up with mine real quick, Weeby. Logan Hot Dog Farrington passes out free glizzies. That's my top item. For listeners out there, Weeby did not send me this rundown that he has not accused me of stealing from him. I never have had access to this rundown, so this is all hearsay from Weeby. Although this was the obvious one, and he is being the gentleman and letting me take it. Logan Farrington scoring his first MLS goal in his rookie season and then proceeding to hand out hot dogs to the crowd after that 5-3 home win for FC Dallas in peak Wednesday night's international window chaos from Major League Soccer. It was dollar hot dog night at Toyota Stadium, and Farrington just spreading the love. Man, he launched that first one into the crowd like a t-shirt cannon launches t-shirts, and it doesn't go great, right? And this is what I love, Weeby. So effective and quick to realize that, hey, I got to change the technique, goes over and just starts, you know, handing them out instead. What a guy, what a moment, unbelievable scenes.
I'm imagining that because it was my favorite part of the video. Apart from the fact that, did you see the box that they handed to him that had the hot dogs? It was the hat box. You know, everybody knows it now. The cowboy hat that FC Dallas gives, like, the player of the match. I think that's how they do it or whatever it is. Either way, it's an awesome tradition. But this was the hat box, and they just filled it up with these hot dogs. I mean, obviously on $1 hot dog night, like, you cannot come up short. If people come to the counter and they want $1 hot dogs, you cannot tell them that we are out of hot dogs. So you have a surplus of dogs, and those must go to all these paying customers, these fans who have enjoyed a wonderful night at Toyota Park. I mean, the second in a row at Toyota Stadium. Well done to FC Dallas, but we have to go back to that first throw. I mean, it's wrapped up in the, it's not foil, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's that, like, foil side. It's that warmth, kind of foil on one side. Yeah, I got
it.
It's you.
Like paper that keeps hot dogs warm, basically, and it completely separates. It's like a sail. Mm-hmm. So the paper goes one way, the actual dog is going another way, and then you see the bun going a different way.
Yeah.
And Hot Dog Farrington, he figures it out quick, and I feel bad for Logan because I just can't stop saying or thinking about the phrase Hot Dog Farrington. And the goal he scored is perfectly fitting of a nickname of Hot Dog Farrington. He hot dogged that thing in. He was throwing step overs, cutting inside. Big boy scoring a golazo made it look like a true, like, Vinny Jr. would be proud of that goal.
No doubt. I didn't have, even knowing that we were going to lead this segment with hot dog chat, I didn't have hot dog becoming a verb on my bingo card. And yet I'm so glad that it has. That's great work on your part, Weeby. It's a great goal. He gets an assist before that, scores a goal, cutting in on that left foot after a couple of step overs inside the box. It's a nice finish across his body. And then you mentioned it, man. You ran it through all the way through. Farrington going and doing all that stuff after the final whistle was incredible. This makes me think of an upgraded version of Jack Mayer's Milkman Senor Leche nickname.
Yes.
Hot Farrington, I think, is pretty clearly now in that S tier of MLS food or beverage related nicknames.
There's some edge to Hot Dog Farrington. Milkman, there's no edge to that, sadly, for Jack Mayer. I just want to say that the MLS Season Pass crew was on the Logan Hot Dog, well, not the Hot Dog track, but the Logan Farrington bandwagon before most others. I mean, BWP, when he was drafted, was texting us at the draft table saying, this guy is good, watch out for him. First couple games when, you know, Petar Musa hadn't arrived and Farrington was getting minutes, I was like, yeah, this guy can play. He's got soft feet. He's really good in sort of combination play when he drops in, but then makes really good runs and seems to have good instincts around the box. And boy, what a combo it is when you went and spent millions of dollars on Petar Musa and he scores a hat trick for FC Dallas, and then Farrington backs it up as well. All right, I'll get to my best thing. We've talked about hot dogs for just a little bit too long. Kai Kamara.
Impossible.
It had been a full year since Kai Kamara's last goal for the Chicago Fire. He had been sitting on 144 goals in MLS regular season play, one behind Landon Donovan for number two on the all-time list for, you know, what, 363 days, 27 games. He's 39 years old now in his 18th MLS season, and I know he had to be thinking it at some point, certainly before he signed for LAFC, and maybe once he got to the team and he was like, I'm not getting a ton of playing time, and Olivier Giroud is coming in the summer. Like, the clock was ticking. Kai needed to get this goal, and he got it in a vintage Kai way, across to the back post, towering header, dunking on somebody. And then afterwards, it wasn't vintage Kai, which I thought was so interesting and admirable as well. You know, we're accustomed to Kai sort of, you know, he has a tendency to celebrate his goals and his accomplishments. And, you know, he's a guy that he's a striker. And afterwards, instead of being like, I did it, I'm finally here, he made it about the team, about finally getting to contribute to LAFC. And, you know, credit to him on that one. But I will say, I went to college with Kai's wife, Kristen, at the University of Kansas. We were both J school students. Huh. And so as soon as it happened, I immediately texted Chris and I said, please tell me all the Kamara kids are up. He's got three kids, all adorable, obviously. And she sent me videos of them jumping up and down, screaming, you know, saying thanks, you know, great job, daddy, well done. And it was just the perfect combination in the Weeby Venn diagram of MLS, you know, history / nerddom and fatherhood. So congratulations to Kai Kamara. I'm so glad for him that he got that one off his back. Now just get another one. Get second for yourself, man. I don't think you're going to catch Chris Wondolowski, but Kai Kamara second all time in MLS record books. That's cool.
I love that, man. I love it. It's coming. And I now have this picture, Weeby, of your children watching and celebrating you anytime they see you on any of the Apple TV stuff. I assume this is like the same level stuff, right?
Yeah,
it's
equal
importance.
This is the 145th MLS wrap-up or countdown that we've seen Daddy on. It's, you know, it's a record. It's a record. No, they do. Actually, you know what? My kid was saying, my son's over here playing FIFA right now, actually. And he was saying the other day, he's like, you know what? I just like watching the highlights, Daddy. I don't think I really like your shows that much. So, we're slowly but surely.
Time. It's all right. It's all right. Yeah, we'll get there.
When you're the dad, they don't think you're that cool. All right, let's dive into the games out west. And I think the game of the weekend in the West may have been sort of a split game. Interconference, LA Galaxy, New York City crossing the country to visit the Galaxy, and the Galaxy walk out with a big victory without Ricky Pooj. Yet again, I think this is a great sign for the Galaxy. What do you think?
Yeah, 100% with you on that. For the Galaxy to go out there and not just to get the result that they got, but also to have the performance that they had, which was a professional one basically all the way around. I have down from this game that they were good defensively, which I feel weird writing about the Galaxy, but they really were in this game against NYCFC. Gave up very, very little at home, which is an edge, sure. But they added they maintained the attacking threat even without Ricky, which I think is incredibly impressive, and added some defensive solidity to that mixture. And it resulted in this really comprehensive, effective, no doubt sort of performance from the Galaxy in front of their home fans. I have so much respect for what the Galaxy did over the offseason, bringing in Will Koontz, having now real change to, or elevating Will Koontz, I should say, now having real change at the top end of their roster. This was the payoff for that moment. This was the payoff of, hey, we're missing the one guy who really kept us going last year and made us entertaining and gave us attacking joy. Now, when we're missing that guy, we don't crumble. We don't have to crumble. We have two pieces on both wings, and we elevated our number nine and said, hey, Dejan Jovetic, we believe in you. We believe that you can lead the line for a team that has ambitions to win every competition they're in at this point, just like the Galaxy at their best, that they could go out there and get this result and play the way that they did and create the chances that they did without their best and most effective attacking player still, which is Ricky Puig. Yeah, it's super impressive.
I think it's it's sort of a message to Ricky in a lot of ways of like, hey, you don't have to be the end all be all. You don't have to be the sun and the moon and the stars. And like every game doesn't have to revolve around you being on the ball in any part of the field that you want to go get it. And you know, like that's Ricky, man. Like there's a reason why he has the most touches in the league, why, you know, he is who he is. And that's because there's one thing that he wants, and it's to affect the game with the ball. But I've talked to Greg Vanney a good bit this year. And what Greg consistently goes back to is that like we need to find a way to fit Ricky's brilliance, because you don't want to break him of what makes him special, but we need to find a fit that into a greater structure. Hmm. And I think if you're the Galaxy right now, you have this tape that you can go to Ricky and say, like, this is not a sacrifice for you to stop dropping in, to try to pick up the ball, to, you know, in some ways, like breaking our defensive structure when you move around the field, because we have to account for where you're at and where the gaps are now that you've opened them up. Like, help us be more balanced. Help us be more collective. Stay higher up the field. Let that double pivot sit behind you and do the work. You know, let these fullbacks and the team move up the field as a group, progress the ball. Let us be more compact so that when we do lose the ball, we can defend quickly because the spaces aren't so big. I mean, so many times Ricky wants to drop in, and then you need one of those midfielders, usually Delgado, to sort of flip and say, okay, well, I need to move forward.
Sure.
So we can progress the ball. I need to move forward so there's an option centrally for Ricky to play with. But when you do that, all of a sudden, it's Ricky and a defensive midfielder, and the spacing's all wrong. And if you lose the ball, how many times have we seen the Galaxy in open space just get ripped apart on counterattacks? And you didn't see that in this game because the guys on the field bought into that structure. And look, structure can get you a really long way. It can improve the Galaxy defensively, which is what they need the most, because the attacking side is not really a doubt. The flip side is the attacking side is so good that even if they improve defensively, Joe, by like, hell, even like 20%, like their ceiling is so much higher.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt. I've had this thought in my mind, and this was sort of swirling around in my brain as the Marco Reus transfer reports are coming out about there being interest from the Galaxy. And that still seems like it's a possibility, even though things have gone a bit quiet recently. You know, the Galaxy have always felt to me like they're one piece away from being a truly great team, not even just next year, but maybe after this summer transfer window as we look towards MLS Cup. Shield's probably not going to happen, but they will have trophy opportunities this season. Like, they're either one defensive piece away that will help them get 20, 10, 5, whatever percent better on the defensive end, which then means they will be that much more effective, or they're one attacking piece, and that could be Marco Reus. We'll see. They're one attacking piece away from being so good in the attack that it doesn't matter how bad they are defensively. I think they are still in that weird gray area where they are still beatable, and we have seen that at times this year. They are vulnerable, and their defense can derail things. Their attack is great, but I don't think it is otherworldly to the point where they are invincible in the way that it kind of feels like Inter Miami might be this season. But if they get that one piece shading either direction, that would be a huge boon for them. The interesting thing is, I still believe that. I still believe that that is probably what needs to happen for the Galaxy. But the more that we watch this group play together, and by this group I mean at least two of the big four, two of Jovetic, Peck, Paincel, and Puig, if at least a couple of those guys are on the field together, it feels like every time I watch them, and this was the case over the weekend when we saw Jovetic and Peck play together, and those were the only two starters in that front four, we get three of the four in this game. Josep Paincel back for the first time since May 15th in the starting 11. These guys seem to be reading each other better now than they did at the start of the season. And that's a really obvious thing to say, but I hope it's encouraging for Galaxy fans, and it should be frightening for fans of the rest of the teams on their schedule and really the entire league. We saw Peck and Jovetic have some really nice combination play over the weekend. We saw the same thing, and it seems like they read each other well on the goal that Jovetic scores, just the little tap in eventually inside the box, but they work together after that turnover in the back from James Sands. These guys seem to be understanding each other more. And so maybe it's not one more piece coming in, although I think they will get one more piece somewhere. But maybe it's just, to your point, Weeby, Ricky Puig saying, hey, I've got a new deal. These guys are in. This is not the Galaxy team that it was a year ago. I don't have to do everything. And he eases off the gas, 10%. And it's everybody else, all three of the rest of the big four, come together and playing together and just getting the reps and that having a natural byproduct of success along the way. Maybe there is still more room for positive growth from this Galaxy team with their current group than I thought there was.
I absolutely think there is. And I would point to Gabriel Peck as the example of really rapid, exciting growth. Because when he arrived, you know, look, there was a little bit of an issue to start, just personal stuff. It's come a while to get to the team. I'm not talking about into the team, like onto the field, but just to the team in terms of I'm on the training field every day. I'm in LA. I'm focused. I'm ready to go. Like, we're locked in. Once he did, the thing that I noticed about him, and you know, played him on the left, he really does prefer to be on the right, cutting on his left foot, though he can play both, is he just didn't seem connected. Like, he wasn't super connected to his teammates. He felt like more of a, you know, get me the winger that's like, yeah, I want the ball and I'm going to go beat that guy. And at the end of beating that guy, I'm either going to cut inside and shoot it, or maybe I'll be in position to cross. But it isn't really in terms of, hey, this collective sort of all the different patterns that Greg likes to have. And okay, you're going to interact with these guys and create overloads here. And, you know, Mickey Yamane is going to help you out in this sense. And Aude is going to be there to be sort of a player to help you combine and create, you know, numbers up situations. He has rapidly figured that out.
Yeah.
And he has rapidly figured out that he doesn't always have to come inside when he's on the right. You know, he got that opportunity because Pantel's been injured. He can run into the depth. And once he gets into the depth and the team advances up the field, okay, now there are opportunities for you to get back in possession and come inside and combine or shoot or go 1v1. He just feels like he's much more integrated into this team, whereas Joe Pantel from the jump, and maybe it was just because he's like so blindingly fast that they were like, yeah, you just run into the depth on the right-hand side and we'll just play the ball in behind and everything will be okie dokie. You know, they're all firing. They look like $20 million worth of winger. And by God, $20 million worth of winger plus Dejan Jovetic equals 11 goals in 1,200 minutes. He's got five more than he had last year in 500 more minutes. And if you're Dejan Jovetic, you're in Shangri-La. Like, this is why you wanted to be in LA. This is the situation that you prayed for. You are the starter on a team that is going to flood you with service. And right now, Joe, on XG per 90, Dejan Jovetic is number one in MLS among players who have played more than like 115 minutes. Tani Olaseyi is tied at 0.9 as well, XG per 90, but Tani has played half the minutes.
Mm.
Like, this is heaven for Dejan.
Yeah, it's the best job in MLS, man. It really is. You could make an argument that there's some Inter Miami job playing next to Messi that is probably, you know, better for your long-term career and for your soccer memories if any of these Miami players romanticize Messi in the way that we do, and I think they very much do. At the same time, there's more pressure playing next to Messi and you got to change your game more than if you're the Galaxy's number nine, where if you're in the right spots, you're going to get the ball and you're going to have opportunities to take really, really good shots. And that's not necessarily taking away from Dejan Jovetic's game. We saw it when he was backing up Chicharito and thriving as a super sub. This guy can score goals and is a very, very good number nine in Major League Soccer, but he's been made to look great this year because he has the players around him. That's the difference from last year to this year. It is another example of Will Kuntz making the right moves, not just to go out there and find talent, but I remember so much of the discussion in the offseason was the Galaxy have two open DP spots. They're going to go out there and they're going to get a winger and they're going to get a number nine. And Will Kuntz said, no, I'm going to go out there and get two DP wingers. And we trust Dejan Jovetic to be that guy for us through the middle. And that has absolutely, positively been the correct call. Jovetic is more than at the level to not just soak up, you know, the occasional chance, but to so often find himself in the exact right spot at the right time to benefit from the talent around him. That's the thing that makes really good nines, is that they end up in good goal scoring spots. And he's done that. And now there's the service meeting him there when he's actually in the spot.
I got to give credit to some guys that don't get a ton of it. You know, Edwin Soria would be one that I would start with for the Galaxy. I don't think most of us looked at this season and said, yeah, probably Soria is going to be a guy you can't take out of the lineup, but he's a number six. Like, and I give that as the biggest possible compliment, and that he is just very honest in his sense and predictable in the spaces he wants to occupy and the way he wants to shield the back line. And when you have Ricky in front of you, you need midfielders that are willing to be positionally like true, very predictable, or you need to have guys that just cover every blade. And that's Mark Delgado next to him. So those two guys don't get enough credit. I think they should get more. And then Jalen Neal back in the lineup has really helped this team. as well. How about New York City? Before we get to RSL, because look, the game of the weekend is very clearly Galaxy RSL at Rio Tinto. You worried about New York City? It's been a little bit of a tough week. Two big time opponents and they lose at home to Columbus. The red card was obviously a complicating factor there, and then go across the country and lose to this this Galaxy team.
It feels about right for NYCFC. You know, if they'd won either this game on the road or gotten maybe a point out of this one on the road and they had either drawn or beaten Columbus at home, I don't think that would have shocked anybody either, which is just to say we are in the NYCFC are in that appropriate zone for their results right now, where they are one of the better teams in Major League Soccer. I don't think even folks inside of NYCFC would imagine that they are at the absolute peak, whether that's of the East or of both conferences. Where they're in fourth right now in the Eastern Conference as we're recording, that feels about right. Maybe they're a little bit lower. I don't think they're above that right now. Maybe Columbus charge back and end up stealing that third spot next to Cincy and Inter Miami. But NYCFC, I think the pretty appropriate week, not to say it wasn't disappointing, because I'm sure it was for NYCFC fans and players and coaches and all that stuff. But this doesn't feel like anything really all that notable in terms of their future.
I mean, it's if you go on bands, and we're just talking the Eastern Conference right now, you have your top band. I think it's pretty clear. It's Miami, it's Cincinnati, and it's Columbus. You have your secondary band, and that's the two teams in New York. And I would say Charlotte probably, and then maybe a Toronto or Nashville are sneaking into that band, but probably not. I think it's probably 3-3. Then you have the next band, which is like, okay, there's something here. Like, it's a good
the tone of your
team.
Voice perfectly describes that band
it's
of
like,
teams.
Toronto, Nashville, Atlanta, maybe you throw Philly and DC in there, and then you got the bottom band, which is Montreal, Chicago, Orlando, and New England. But look, the bottom band is like very close to that third band as well. So to me, it's really those top two bands, and then just an absolute free for all out in the East. I think I called it a mid-off a few shows ago, and I still basically feel that
accurate.
Way.
Yep.
How about RSL before we move on to Dallas and their 5-3 win? Just real quick, RSL against Kansas City. Boy, Montreal didn't give RSL any space and got a shutout. Kansas City somehow turned it into a track meet against Andres Gomez and Anderson Julio, and wouldn't you know it, they paid the price.
Yeah, that's an oopsie moment from SKC. This was not a well-played game from Sporting Kansas City and a lot of the little things. I don't think Peter Vermes will be happy about any of that stuff. I saw this on social because I don't get to, much like your children, it sounds like, I don't get to watch all of the wrap-up and other stuff in studio. I saw you guys doing a segment on Young Player of the Year, right? And I don't know who all was on. I don't remember, but Cole Bassett's name was mentioned. There was somebody else's name that was mentioned, and Andres Gomez was mentioned. Were you on that segment? Or
I was. Gomez, okay. Gomez was my guy. Was my guy.
Good. Because we're aligned on this 100%. Yes. Go ahead.
Sasha took Matty Bogusz. Good choice.
Nah, that's right.
Really like that choice. I think Cole Bassett is a great choice for BWP.
Also but wrong.
Right now, I don't even think it's really a competition. I think it's very clearly Andres Gomez. His raw talent, like ability to affect games and to put fear into defenders and fullbacks, was obvious last year. What was also obvious is that he had not yet married that part of the game with final product.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so exciting this season to see him just make not just the leap, but like this is what every winger prospect goes through. It's like, hey, okay, well, yeah, cool. Like you have great moments and you cause problems, but do you finish them? Do you make the right decision with the ball for the assist, with the finish that you choose, with the moments that you, with the way that you manipulate defenders, the timing of your runs? All those things are starting to come together very quickly for Andres Gomez, and the physical gifts are just so obvious. I mean, you just look at that goal that he picks the ball up off Kansas City's back line, and he's like, beep, beep. Yeah, nobody's going to be anywhere close to me here. Like, I'm so much faster than you. My pace is at a different level. You know, we're talking like FIFA 99 versus some 70s. Like, I'm just going to waltz away from you. And then the question is, can I finish? And he dinks the keeper. Like, that's a finish that I didn't think he had in the locker. Yeah. That's composure I didn't think he had last year. And credit to Mastroeni and the staff. Credit to Chicho Arango, who seems to have made him very comfortable and confident very, very quickly. And more than anything else, credit to Andres Gomez, who arrived in a country that's not his own, his first move away from Colombia, and was just like, yeah, the first season maybe wasn't perfect, but I'm going to force my way into the Colombian national team on the fringes, and I'm going to start balling.
It's awesome to watch. It's absolutely awesome to watch. And he's the obvious young player of the year as the number. He's the number two guy for RSL at this point. It's not Diego Luna. It's not Matt Crooks. It's nobody besides Chicho as the number one guy for the best team in the West, a team with legit trophy aspirations. And then it's Andres Gomez. He is that dude. He's tied for seventh in the league in goals as we're recording right now on 10. He's been absolutely fantastic. And that's not to try and take things away from Bassett or from Bogusz, both good players. And Cole Bassett is a good shout. But Andres Gomez is doing stuff that those guys simply aren't. I know they're different players in different spots, but he's been unbelievable. The other thing on Gomez, because I know we got to move on, is I talked with Pablo Mascherani earlier this year for a big piece that I wrote for Backfield about RSL's transformation, which I think is maybe the best story in MLS this year still. And I wrote it maybe a month or so ago. Mascherani cited about Gomez sort of a lack of tactical maturity last year, which is understandable for a young player. That makes sense. This new guy with all the context that you already dropped. And so this year, what do they do? Well, they simplified his role. His job is to stay wide on the right. He doesn't have to come inside. He doesn't have to worry about, hey, how do I read this situation with my fullback? He's wide, so do I tuck in? And when do I tuck in? And how do I show for the ball? No, he gets the ball in space on the right side, either in possession wide with room to drive forward or in transition, which is where he did so much damage in this game. He's been unreal and is a huge credit to him and Mascherani and that coaching staff and really RSL as a whole.
Yeah, no, their game model is really fun. And digging into Pablo has been just a joy this year. He seems to have really found a place after some tough times in the offseason where he's just so comfortable and confident and the leader that he is. It just feels like it percolates throughout that entire club right now. I just want to say, Diego Luna balled out in this game. He had some amazing passes. He's got 3 goals and 9 assists. So we probably got to force him into that young player of the year conversation. But that's neither here nor there. Massive game of the weekend coming up in Rio Tinto. Excuse me, not Rio Tinto. Gosh, I'm still living in the riot
days. Get out of the past,
it's America First. Like, geez, what am I doing here? Oh gosh. But America First Field will host at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Salt Lake in LA. On Saturday night, that's the game of the weekend, in my opinion. All right, Dallas 5, Minnesota 3. Interesting statistical anomaly here for Dallas. Of course, they scored 5 goals. It's the first time in 3 years they've done that. But 8 shots for FC Dallas, all of them on target, Joe. 5 goals from that. Petar Musa with 3. And then we talked about, of course, Logan Farrington. And then Jesus Ferreira, the Cheetah, got 1 as well. What have you seen under Peter Luxain? That's 2 home games and 2 big wins for FC Dallas.
It hasn't been a total reversal from where Dallas had ended up, not necessarily where they planned to be, where they'd ended up under Nico Estevez before he was let go. You know, they started in preseason and a lot of us bought the hype. I was at least halfway there on some of the hype about Dallas kind of reshaping.
I bought.
Yeah, I know you bought, and I wasn't too far behind you, so I'm not trying to paint myself in a much better light here, but it just hasn't worked. And a lot of the failures have been predictable, and ETR has already talked about them, so I'm not going to do it here. Go and listen to Weeby and Tom. I think that was last week talking about it because you guys did a good job. It's not a huge departure then from where Dallas had ended up, which was not a possession dominant team, a team that will use the ball in moments, but will also sit a little bit deeper, and they're not going to press super high. A lot of those same somewhat pragmatic attacking principles and the same on the defensive end have stayed the same under Luxain. This game, though, was different from the first game that Luxain coached on the sidelines. That one was over the weekend, I believe. This one was different because we saw Dallas attack not in that 3-back for long stretches, but in much more of a super fluid interchanging 4-2-3-1 shape. At least that's how I saw it. I had a hard time pinning down the midfield and attacking structure for pieces of this game, but the back line certainly seemed to me to be a pure back four, where Junqua was playing as a left back and Paul Areola was playing as a straight up right back. He's an outside back at this point in his Dallas career, or at least it seems that way. And that paid off well for Petar Musa's 3rd goal of the game, where it's Areola in a slightly narrower position, but he is still in that right back role, playing the ball to Sebastian Legette, and it's a lovely ball that leads Legette into the box, and then Legette finds Musa, and Musa takes care of the rest for that third goal of the game for Dallas that sort of seemed to put this one out of reach or the beginning of that process. I love the idea of Areola playing deeper because he's not a difference-making attacker at this point in his career. He's got the work rate still, but he's not a goal threat, and he's not always a chance creation threat either, and if you got to carry his contract, I think a really good way to do that is to get something out of him as a fullback. So we're seeing little changes. I don't think we're going to see a tactical overhaul from this group because, let's face it, they never really found their footing to begin with in 2024.
Yeah, I think the overhaul is personnel-wise. And I'm not saying to go out and like sign a bunch of new guys, though a little bit of midfield depth and certainly another center back would help. I think it's just being healthy. You know, it's Ferreira being in the team. It's Legette being on the field, which he wasn't for large stretches at the end under Nico. It's Tafari not sitting the bench in critical moments. I mean, there are all these things. The Otamendi is back in the team, and that helps considerably. But they were just so dangerous in transition. I mean, and the ability to get vertical is really, I mean, every coach, especially playing out of this 3-4-3, that at least that's what they are marking it down. That's what you want. You want to find opportunities to get into open space, to go to goal quickly. And then when you have Petar Musa, who hadn't scored in five games before this, by the way, with the sort of calmness that he has in front of goal, like a lot of strikers would be pressing really hard in this moment. But if you watch Petar Musa in this game, the chances he gets, he is just so composed. There's no rush. There's no hurry. It's like, okay, well, this is the right finish. It doesn't have to be smashed. It doesn't have to be dinking off the post and in. It just needs to be a couple feet to the outside of the keeper. I'm calm. Like I've done this before. This is why you paid me all the money. I'm an in-prime striker with a history of goal scoring. That's good service. And when I get good service, I score a lot of goals. Oh, by the way, I'm also pretty underrated when it comes to getting on the ball, holding it up a little bit, turning and playing really nice through balls or outlet passes to wingers, which he did for Ferreira as well. I saw a clip that Dallas put out, and they're really, boy, I got to tell you, since the Luke Sane change, they're really driving the social media content. There's been some good stuff coming out from them, but it was Petar Musa getting the game ball from the Hunts and saying, hey, look, guys, this is who we want to be. Like, let's not forget this feeling. Let's not forget this performance and know that we can be much better than we've been so far. And yet we have two wins and we're climbing the table a little bit and we're getting healthy. And, you know, clearly they have attacking threats, but you know, it's MLS, man. It's MLS. Little changes, a little bit of an emotional high, can do a lot for a season. And Dallas should certainly believe that they have every opportunity to get around that playoff line and climb above it.
Yeah, it doesn't take much, right? I think that's kind of what you're getting at. You get a couple guys healthy, you get Tafari back on the field, all the things that you mentioned. If you do that stuff, suddenly you can overcome some adversity. And Dallas did have to do that in this game. They struggled a little bit early on. Martin Paas made an uncharacteristic error on a goal in this one as well.
I'm giving him a pass. I'm telling you right now.
You give him a pass on that one?
Just because, look, it's like one of those things with goalkeepers where it's like you have deposits into your account and you have debits. And I just feel like he has deposited so much for FC Dallas.
No,
it's like, he's like, okay, well, look, guys, I got to withdraw a goal. Like, you know, like I screwed this one up.
It's
like,
time.
Withdrawal here, but we still have a lot of savings left over. So don't come after me.
No doubt. And now at this point, you couple some pieces that you actually start to like, and it's a little easier to remember why it was simpler to believe in this team before the year started. And the problems are still very real, but to get Petar Musa on the board in this way, to get him his first hat trick in Major League Soccer, like this is the Petar Musa game until further notice. It's great steps in the right direction. The flip side is Minnesota made life easy for Dallas for long stretches of this game by Bongi not finishing a couple of his chances early on, and even on that goal that it's Farrington to Jesus Ferreira on the fourth one for Dallas in this one that makes it 4-2. Minnesota United are in the game at that point. It's been a weird one. There's still punches left to be thrown. It's only the 75th minute, and Minnesota United's transition defending is just so poor on Farrington, who has so much time to pick up his head, to look forward, to find Ferreira.
Oh my gosh. I gave Petar Musa the credit.
I know. It furthers your Farrington.
Had that. Oh my gosh. It's huge. I'm ruining my own narrative. I'm screwing myself.
It's a great moment. There's no doubt about that. Minnesota United just make it way too easy. And Eric Ramsey's not going to be pleased about that. This Minnesota United team is struggling for just bodies right now and seem to be struggling a bit for energy. Yep. And it looked that way to close out this game. Not a performance that they will want to remember. The result, I think, ends up looking a little flattering at the end of the day, which is weird because the XG in this game is all wonky because Minnesota United both end with a penalty that makes it 5-3 at the end of this one. And they have a bunch of those chances in the first half that they don't convert and then don't create a ton in the second half. So a weird game for Minnesota, who are stuttering a little bit right now.
I would like to extend an apology right now to Hot Dog Farrington because I took this wonderful moment off his plate that I mean, these are all the things that I say that I love about him. And I thought it was Petar Musa. I don't know why.
The ketchup right off the dog, Weeby.
I'm not a ketchup guy, by the way. I'm, you know,
that's just a mistake on your part, frankly.
Spicy mustard, fine. Relish. Yeah, maybe if we've got them, like some nicely finely diced red onions, but you know,
right.
Someday
you brought me back in on the onions, man. You did.
Yeah, that's a good one. Eric Ramsey's in the MLS blender though, right now. He said, you know, we've got to be level-headed, stoic enough about the situation that we're in, and we really got to grind through this difficult period and learn a lot about what we can do. I know it's difficult for Ramsey. You know, look, Tani's gone on international duty. So is Dane St. Clair, who might be an even bigger miss. Teemu Pukki is injured at the exact wrong time. Mm. Even Kirby and Arriaga is not in the team. He might be going to Kaiserslautern. But, like, this is MLS, and this is MLS in the summer with big tournaments. You have to find a way to survive and maybe not thrive. You know, look, if you're the top teams, if you're the Miamis and the Cincinnatis, that's the expectation. But yeah, if you're sitting around in that mid-table zone, this is just survival time, and Minnesota are latching in right now and trying to figure out how to keep hold of the cart as it rumbles downhill over the rocks.
And they're going to, right? That was the whole point of how successful they were to start the season. I think everybody realized, hey, this team is good and probably better than we thought they would be without Reynoso. Certainly better than we thought they'd be without Reynoso. But were they third in the West kind of good?
Are they
and
great? The West, no.
Right, exactly. So they build up a cushion that always felt like it was going to precede some sort of fall. And we're seeing that now. It took until there were a couple more international absences. I wrote this for Backfield in the Monday mega column. This Minnesota team is not built to withstand a couple of those kinds of absences. They can't lose both strikers. They can't lose a goalkeeper. They can't lose like multiple center backs, multiple guys who are playing at outside center back for this team. They don't have the depth to do that. And frankly, few teams in Major League Soccer have the depth to do that. Minnesota United certainly do not. So this all feels really predictable to me right now with Minnesota. I think they will hang around the top six in the playoffs. I don't think they're going to be in that wildcard conversation, although it is possible as time goes on. I think they built themselves such a nice little perch to start the year that they can withstand a few of these really disappointing results and performances and go and reinforce a little bit and have guys by July 18th that can help them stay towards the top.
I had somebody text me, and a Minnesota fan, and say, they were like, yeah, we're going to finish fourth. And I said, no chance. Am I being too harsh in saying no chance?
Yeah, just because, like, who is? You know, you look at the standings and the top three feel very, very real. I imagine it's going to be LAFC on top by the end of the season. But RSL and the Galaxy are going to be right there in the top three. And then we'll talk about the Rapids in just a minute. Do we feel great about Colorado finishing fourth? I don't. You go down the list. Vancouver, six feels just about right for them.
Yeah.
Keep going down the list. So is it honestly, the most likely outcome? No, but is it impossible? No, it's totally impossible.
Had Houston not dropped those 2 points at home, I might have been pointing to the Dynamo because of the way they defend and the way that their attack can be elevated when Ponce comes in. But they play too many incomplete games. And it goes back to what I was saying about the East and the mid-off in the East. I'm not saying Minnesota and Colorado are mid, but I'm probably saying that about, I'm like 50% of their performances. Yeah. You know, like, and this is the moment where it's like, okay, who are you going to be? Like, we're halfway through the season. Like, we have a good idea, but you have this opportunity to change the narrative and change your position in the standings. Like, are you going to find some consistency? Are you going to find out how to use your squad and really get the more out of less during these summer months when everybody's away? That's the open question. In the West, it's pretty open from four, probably all the way down to, 11th. And that's because Joe in 12th is St. Louis City, and I don't think it's getting better for them, man. Home loss again, 3-0 to the Rapids. I have, is St. Louis boned on the rundown here? We'll talk about that in a second, but let's start with the positives. Rapids, 3-0 win. Georgie with the hat trick. He's got 7 goals. His career high is 9. It took him a second to get comfortable, but boy, he's delivering now.
Yeah, no doubt. And this game makes it a lot easier given some of the moments that were handed to Colorado when we see it on the first goal, in the 9th minute. It's a long throw. This game was the long throw-in game, Weeby, which I love so much.
That's a shameful goal to give up, by the way, Joe.
It's an incredibly poor goal to give up. There's no doubt about that. To let the ball bounce in the box in the way that it does, it's ridiculous from St. Louis. But both teams tossing long throw-ins back and forth, which is just the right thing to do when you're in the final third and you've got a guy, which is most guys, who can chuck it into the box. It's statistically the right play so often, and maybe at a point in time that will change as everybody gets on board and defenses adjust, but we're not there yet, certainly. And it benefited Colorado in this game. It also benefited St. Louis because they get the penalty off of a long throw, and then Lewin bangs it off the top bar. But Colorado looked like the Colorado team that they've been over the last few weeks, and it was more than enough for them in this game to go out there and really own the match in open play against St. Louis. This Rapids team does stuff differently than anybody else in Major League Soccer at this point. They keep their front three so narrow all the time. It's Rafa Navarro, and then it's Omar Fernandez on the left and Kevin Cabral on the right in this game. They keep those guys narrow, which is not unusual because a lot of teams will keep their wingers and tuck them inside and have fullbacks overlap. But they don't do the last part. They so rarely send one or both or even one of those fullbacks forward. And it's all about depth. The whole attacking game plan for the Rapids is about depth. How do we send wave after wave of runner into the box at the right time? Georgie is sort of that accent runner behind Navajo. And then it's Cole Bassett even behind Georgie, or maybe they'll swap spots at times. And I can understand, to go back to the young player convo, why Bassett's been involved, because he's been so effective crashing the box, and the system seems to really accommodate the fact that, hey, Colorado, we don't have a through ball threading number 10. We don't have a Lucho Acosta. We don't have a Carlesio. We don't have an Almada. Georgie is a hybrid. He's kind of part winger, part attacking midfielder, part number eight, part four other things. Cole Bassett's not a standard ball progressing number eight either. These are guys that want to crash and want to get the ball in good spots, and Armas has designed the system well to accommodate that. Toss in some really poor defending from St. Louis, and you've got a dominant 3-0 win on the road.
Speaking of goalkeepers who have so many credits that debit is not going to hurt them. Boy, that was a mind-bending moment from Roman Berkey to come out of that box, and you could just feel how much he's pressing. I mean, even in the previous game in stoppage time, when he gets like 50 yards out and is just like, screw it, I'm hitting this. Like, nobody else is scoring. I'm just going to give it a try.
Which was an awesome moment, by the way.
It was sick. And then in this match where he's like, I got to hurry and get the ball out. We got to start attack. Let's go. And just throws it directly into the feet of Georgie. I'm struggling to see how it's going to get better for St. Louis, Joe. And the reports are, and it's not a report, Bradley Carnell said it, that Sam Dinneran is involved in transfer and trade talks. Sounds like they're trying to move on, which makes sense given the recent history between Dinneran and Carnell, just in terms of playing time and discipline. How do you fix this? Like, is this fixable? We're at 3 wins right now in 18 games. They're 2-5-3 at home, -9 goal differential. And they're just, I know they get into the box a lot. They don't get good shots, nope. And they're not finishing.
Yeah. I'll start on the opposite side of the argument that I'm supposed to be making, just to reinforce the point you're making, Weeby. They have the worst shots in MLS. They take the lowest quality non-penalty shots based off of non-penalty XG in Major League Soccer. SKC are right down there with them. That is not the kind of company that you want to be keeping and leading in the year 2024. Yeah.
That was the same last year.
Yeah.
It's basically the same number as it was last year.
And you take away the Kip Keller back passes of the world, and all of a sudden things look different, which is what we were saying all along about St. Louis. This does not bring me joy to have you tweeting out sort of, hey, send any questions or whatever you got for ETR. And we've got folks in your mentions and in my mentions and Ben Wright's mentions saying, hey, please don't talk about St. Louis. But I think there is a world where things get better, and we're seeing St. Louis be proactive with their summer transfer window action. We've already seen them go out there and sign Cedric Teuchert, who's coming in from the second Bundesliga. And now the reports are that they're getting Marcel Hartel, who was one of the leaders for St. Pauli in their promotion push, which was successful in the second Bundesliga. He's an in-prime, flexible attacking player who could be a second forward underneath João Klaus in a 4-triple-2, or he could be more of an attacking midfielder and somebody who's either the tip of a midfield three in a 4-2-3-1, or could be one of the two guys in the half spaces that we've seen Bradley Carnell roll out so many times, where it's him and it's Vasilev, or pick a guy out of a hat for St. Louis, even though that hat is thinning with a few injuries. You know, again, I said he's 28 years old. He's in his prime. 26 combined non-penalty goals and assists on his team last year for a team that was very, very good in their league, which always inflates some of those numbers. St. Louis will not be that. But the whole, really, H-O-L-E, for the St. Louis team is in the attack right now. You trust Roman Berkey, but you don't trust the guys that he's trying to go throw the ball out to at this point. Getting Leuven back in this team is massive. He is a best 11 caliber player. He's so good at the number eight, eight and a half kind of role. There's just nothing besides him and João Klaus. And there's nobody besides Leuven to pull the strings. And so getting a couple of guys in early who are very good in a league that is developing a nice little track record for importing talent from the second tier in Germany into Major League Soccer. Yeah, I mean, St. Louis right now, just a few points out of the playoff line when you toss in their game in hand and assume they get something, which is not necessarily a safe assumption.
I mean, it's MLS, man. They got 3 wins in 18, Joe. I wouldn't assume too much given the vibe right now.
And that's fair enough. But basically 2 out of every 3 teams in Major League Soccer make the playoffs. And the goal for St. Louis this year is get into the playoffs. And that was always the goal from the start. They were never going to follow up last year. If you bring in a guy who can get you 8 or 9 goals in Hartel between now and the end of the season. That's maybe a bit generous. Let's say 7 goals between now and the end of the season. And you get another couple of pieces, which they're already doing. I don't like this St. Louis roster. I don't think it's a good team. I think they waited way too long to make changes. But can they go out there and sneak into the postseason and finish in 9th? Yeah, absolutely they can.
They can. But they got another month before any of those additions are even available, first of all. And they have no momentum. And the vibes are bad. And look, when the vibes are bad and you have no momentum, you need something to get you out of that. Whether it's a result, whether it's a signing, whether sometimes it's a coaching change. I'm not saying that they should change coaches. It's way too early to be talking about that. And I see some of their supporters having those rumbles. But yeah, this is to me what happens when the roster, to your point, is just not quite up to the level of the best teams in the Western Conference. It just really isn't. I made the argument about Mikel Ua, like, okay, well, look, maybe we've been too hard on him given his history and his price tag. He's actually been it's a pretty good return on investment. Like, you'd probably say the same general thing about Joe Klaus. Joe Klaus hasn't been some like everywhere he goes volume goal scorer before. I mean, he's pressing a little bit. He's taking bad shots right now. He has more quality than he's shown. But I don't think you can look at Joe Klaus and be like, hey, that guy has to carry a playoff team. To me, that's an unreasonable expectation to put on Joe Klaus.
Yeah, it is. And to go back to the offseason, St. Louis let 21 goal contributions go. And Jared Stroud and Nico Joachini. And they were compensated for those moves, yes. But they never replaced those players. They never actually went out and said, hey, for the first more than 2/3 of the season, we're going to go out there and have guys who can help us win games now. They didn't do that. I think they were a little bit high off of how they finished last year. And now they're paying the price for it. So I don't like the St. Louis roster. I think it's a bad roster as it's currently constructed. My point is simply with an elite goalkeeper, and Roman Berkey is that, with an elite option in central midfield for decent center back play, for a striker who can give you 12 to 14 goals a season, and multiple, seems like, very good reinforcements coming in for that last push in the season. You get the Little Leagues Cup trial run, and then you enter the MLS season, regular season play again. This things are not over for St. Louis, even though I don't think there is a big light at the end of the tunnel in 2024.
I think you're probably right. It's not over, but it's like, half.
It's not
over.
Where you want to be.
It's like half over. All right. You know what? Anders is saying we have to wrap. And, I was talking about with you and Ben, I was like, well, let's do like 20 minutes each. And typical of any Weeby-led show, we've done far more than that. And I am far more grateful than you will ever know. Big thanks to Joe Lowry and Ben Riot for helping me out. Of course, Backfield is the spot. You read Matt Doyle's column every week. I know you do, but I always go second straight to Backfield to read both of you on what went down in the Eastern Western Conference. Thank you so much for everything you're doing as far as coverage of Major League Soccer and much, much more. Before I let you go, just tell the people what you're doing this summer, what they can find. Give them the big sell, because I know that I'm not counting any of the dollars going out of my bank account every month. It is well worth the investment to subscribe to Backfield.
I'm throwing up heart signs to Weeby over the webcam. Thanks, Weeby. That's really nice.
I know how to make
a
sell.
You do. That's well done.
I'm bought and sold. I'm a subscriber.
Yeah, I've got your Venmo, so I'll send that over after. No, we're making a big push this summer for Backfield. Keep in the MLS Monday column. It's going to be regular throughout the summer when there are full game weeks. We're excited about that. Really keeping that momentum going. And then tomorrow, I'm hopping on a plane to Dallas, Texas, and I'll be following the U.S. men's national team all throughout the Copa America, given our subscribers on the ground coverage all the way through their tournament run, whether that ends in the group stage, which would be a shock and a story in and of itself, or a quarterfinal game in Phoenix or Las Vegas, or maybe something more improbably special than that. We're going to be on the ground all the way through, really good comprehensive coverage. Got a few tricks up our sleeves for that. Very, very excited. Little discount on the site as well. Go check that stuff out. And that's the end of my spiel.
Discounts like that. Sounds like now is the time to go get on the Backfield train. All right. That's it for us. Enjoy the weekend, everybody. Just another packed slate. I'm tired. I need some rest. I'm sure you do too. We'll see you on Monday. Enjoy Saturday night on MLS Season Pass. Of course, things start at 6:30 p.m. Eastern time with the countdown straight into the 360 and whatever games you want to watch. And then the wrap-up at 12:30, which you can watch live if you're a night owl on the West Coast, or you can watch it on demand. All right. Enjoy the rest of your week, everybody. Adios.